Hello and welcome once again to Core Ideas, a paleolimnology podcast where we delve into all things lake sediments. And as always, we are your co-hosts, myself, Adam Jaziorski.
And Josh the Inkpot. Thanks for coming back again.
And this week, we're doing something slightly different. We're not going to be actually talking a huge amount about paleo specifically this week. I guess we're going on a bit of a tangent, starting a new arc that we're going to call Contagious Ideas. this is really firing off last week where we tried to talk about paleolimnology in the popular media, and it kind of degenerated into a bit of a talk about environmental awareness and general attitudes to that. So we thought, okay, we scratched the surface in many ways. Let's build on that and just, you know, delve into the timeline. And it's interesting in that we're beginning in like the 1800s. It's a very paleo-friendly timeline, but we're really talking about today a lot of the issues and how they emerge into public consciousness that we spend a lot of time looking to today with paleo.
Yeah.
Or at least that's the idea.
Yeah, I think last week's discussion was an interesting one. And we looked at some of the more recent environmental problems and things that have been directly addressed or attempted to be addressed with paleolimnology. But in that kind of discussion, you end up, you know, going a little bit broader, and it was a rambly kind of discussion, but it was a very open-ended discussion where we talked about a bunch of different things, which was really interesting. And it brought up some ideas as we were thinking about what we might want to talk about this week of things we might want to delve a little bit deeper on and go a little bit beyond the paleos. We're not going to really try and say that we can use lake sediments to track the decline in different species that have occurred over time, but they're all important in sort of how we get to the environmental awareness that we would hope that a lot of people have in the modern world.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we're not going to try and shoehorn in paleo elements to today, but you know, there's key things like the development of nuclear power, which we've talked about, or nuclear weapons leading into cesium. That's something we can track today, but really talking today, it's more a bit about how something like the general protest against nuclear weapons and then into nuclear power was fashioned by things like the Three Mile Island accident and Chernobyl. And Chernobyl definitely left a paleo record.
For sure. And, you know, a lot of the things will begin in the Victorian era, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Of course, we can track those sorts of things with paleo techniques, and all sorts of different indicators in the sediments can give you an idea of those kind of changes and the onset of those changes. Things like we talked about with the Golden Spike for when we would set the onset of the Anthropocene. And we have to keep that in mind, even if we don't directly mention it.
All right. So, you know, in terms of where to begin, I've already mentioned kind of the Victorian era. And I thought it was interesting doing some reading about this, it's one of those things where in your mind, you know this, but then you try and put a timeline together and it all makes a lot of sense of the transition from nature being something that was subjugated. And you think of like very symmetrical Victorian era gardens. It's like, we will make nature conform to the way we want it to. And then the earliest roots of, I guess, environmental awareness, environmentalism, I don't know what kind of label you'd want to put on it, but the transition from it being nature being something subjugated to something with intrinsic value of its own potentially being lost, at least in a Western European kind of consciousness setting, really seemed to grow out of pushback against some of the developments in the Industrial Revolution in the mid to late 1800s, really.
Yeah, such a rapidly changing time period. It's perhaps not all that surprising that viewpoints and opinions on all sorts of different subjects were also rapidly evolving at that time period. You know, in such a short amount of time, going from, you know, the way in which people had lived for centuries to a completely different way of life for everything related to economics, innovation, all of those different things. Yeah. What a change in the history of our species and all of the things related to how we impact the environment. The first real large scale potential to cause significant changes to the broader environmental setting.
Yeah. And so there was a big change, I guess, from, you know, the equivalent of a medieval tannery just being located on the outskirts of the village because of the, you know, short range impacts to, you know, you get to 1863 and you're getting the first real environmental laws coming into effect in response to, you know, gaseous hydrochloric acid being released, you know, above residential areas effectively and, you know, using the air as an open sewer on a large, large scale and, you know, causing great harm. And so it makes sense that it all snapped together very quickly. But all of a sudden, you know, we're not dealing with, you know, you just turn the corner or go around the corner and you don't see what you don't want to see anymore. Like the effects are so much bigger because the scale of production was so much bigger than what I've been seeing before.
Yeah, the soot coming off of the blacksmith's forge in the small town is not going to be of concern to the entire populace of the town, let alone, you know, the greater county. But when you have factories producing all sorts of different products and burning coal at, you know, massive amounts, of course, it's going to be recognized by much broader population. And because of that, there's going to be some pushback and there's going to be the need to introduce some of these different mechanisms to attempt to control that, at least by some people who want to do that.
Yeah. And I thought it was cool reading up again. You know, this is a classic example and covered in like grade 10, 11 biology or very in terms of natural selection at work, but the black peppered moths in England and how, you know, very rapidly you saw a change in response to the vast amounts of soot that were being pumped up into the air that were changing the color of the trees writ large. So you had like black phenotypes that were initially incredibly rare, with the first recorded specimen being in 1811, first live specimen being caught in 18, or documented at least, live specimen being caught in 1848. But within 50 years, the dark-colored phenotypes, or the black moths, were in the Greater Manchester area being reported at 98% of the total population. Just this complete swing of these really, all of a sudden, you know, what was a deleterious, I guess, phenotype, because you were easier to be seen on trees by birds, all of a sudden, you know, that is the way to be if you want to live.
Yeah. An example that many biology students, well, many students are familiar with, but just unbelievable to imagine the change being driven by something like the human production of carbon particles. It still floors me.
And then also, you know, from the 60s onward, have bounced back the other way in response to laws and regulations and, you know, societal changes in terms of that is not cool anymore. And, you know, the dark phenotype is, I'm not sure what the exact numbers are, but it's definitely nowhere near 98% anymore.
Yeah, clearly a plastic trait in that species. Cool. And then I guess at the other, you know, we talked a little bit, thinking about the broader ways in which humans were impacting the environment and leading to environmentalism. Those are both really good examples of the production of harmful materials, whether it be contaminants related to like soda ash production or carbon emissions from factories. At the same time, we also have the kind of mechanization, the large scale industrialization of consuming species, whether that be the hunting of passenger pigeons in North America, or the bison, the plains bison in North America, really corresponds to about the same time period, that latter part of the 19th century, where we got to the point where, you know, we could consume species, we could take species out of the environment at industrial scales, just as we were producing emissions at industrial scales. And because of that, at the same time, we have the onset and the generation of some of the more conservation-themed environmental protection activities and activism in many different areas, but a lot of them really centered around the United States in particular.
Yeah, just the idea today that something like the passenger pigeon, you know, obviously extinct almost a century before we were around, but just that this huge thing like dominated the airs of like Eastern North America in these colossal flocks. And part of it was just, you know, the fact that it was unimaginable to the people that they would ever run out, you know?
Yeah. I don't think anyone was thinking, well, let's wipe these things off the face of the earth. You know, it must have seemed like an endless resource, and you can scale that to all different locations. Like, the fisheries resources off the Grand Banks and the Atlantic cod fishery in Western or Eastern Canada, it must have just seemed impossible that you could ever depopulate such a bountiful resource in the environment. Like, because, you know, the passenger pigeon flocks, the claim that it would have taken days for them to fly overhead and, you know, blotted out the sun. How could you, you know, a bunch of people with firearms, wipe out such a resource, but yet, you know, they in did. Only 50-40 years, they were gone.
Yeah. And it, you know, you had some recognition because there were conservation efforts put in place. And in the case of the passenger pigeon, they were ineffective. I guess there were various regulations and groups trying to protect it or protect them or control the harvests in some shape or form. Mm-hmm. But it just was too little too late in the end. And the decline was too precipitous.
Yeah.
Like the tipping point was not recognized until it had been passed, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I don't want to give people a free pass. The industrial hunting of the plains bison, they were intending to take as many of them as they possibly could. You know, it wasn't they were, you know, not aware of the fact that the numbers were declining every time a hunt would go on. So there was definitely a selfishness associated with all of those efforts. It certainly spurred a conservation movement writ large across the United States and other locations as well.
And, you know, you just when you look at the numbers like the bison, you know, estimated peak of 25 million down to, you know, less than 600 by the late 1880s. Mm-hmm. And that became something of a success story because, unlike the passenger pigeon,
bison
exists today.
Yeah,
there are bison herds today. I have no real sense of how big the herds are, and there are private herds and stuff like that in terms of...
Yeah, it's a very complicated resource. A lot of them on private land.
But you know, and in part that is due to people going, okay, no. There are the recognition that there are limits to what can be taken. And, you know, they were able to do with the bison what they weren't able to do with some other things. And
yeah, some of it for recognizing the fact that these resources have intrinsic value, whether it be the air or the animals or the water, whatever it is. And then also, I think one of the kind of hallmarks of conservation is not just to say never take any of them, it's to let's do this at a sustainable level so that there are resources for future generations to go and hunt. Maybe not bison so much as some at that time period because of the precipitous decline, but you know, that's the hallmark of conservation for all other game species is, you know, it's not that we never want to take them, we want to take them at a sustainable level for in perpetuity.
And, you know, and then these conservation efforts led into the development of what would become the park systems, But what I thought was really crazy, if you look at Yellowstone National Park, which would be, I guess, in many ways, the first national park in the whole world, and obviously in the United States, in 1872, some section of it was protected. But I guess, you know, I'm not a student of American history in any way, shape, or form.
No,
you know, this is obviously, you know, not very long after the Civil War. But I didn't have in my mind until doing some reading about this how well it slotted in with the general era of westward expansion. And mm-hmm. so I found it crazy that the first detailed expedition to what would become Yellowstone National Park was only a couple of years before, in like the 1860s.
Yeah.
Like, so in many ways, this was, you know, and then I guess you have to look into when, like, what the date would be of the Louisiana Purchase. But this was like, you know, in many ways, the wilds still, you know, like, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Industrial Revolution has gone on. You know, you're having the wiping out of things like the bison and the passenger pigeon. But in many ways, you know, outside of the coastal lines on the map, most of the western interior of North America is largely unexplored.
While yeah, many areas for sure. Yeah, oh, yeah. The factories of New England are a world away from Wyoming.
Yeah. And I guess putting those two things together, is, you know, there's a bit of a cognitive dissonance going on in my mind of like how wild the West was.
And how quickly that can be brought about, that some sort of protection could be put into place. 3 years ago, I mean, think about how slowly many legislative processes can occur in the modern world. 3 years is a very small amount of time. You could not establish a new park in in that kind of time.
From a bureaucratic point of view, it was able to be done because it was new, right?
Yeah.
No, mm-hmm. no outside of, you know, the indigenous groups that were obviously being displaced by the westward expansion.
Yeah, at the same time, having horrible atrocities perpetrated upon them. Yeah, at the same time as they explored and expanded west.
Expanding west and, you know, I forget what the phrase that would go along with that is in terms of the western expansion. But, you know, that basically a bit of a race was going on. We want to stake our claim here. And then before anybody else can.
Canada would have been the same time period a little bit later, but Algonquin Provincial Park here in Ontario, which is sort of the large area that most people are familiar with, was established in, again, the late 1900s, 1893. And the whole American park system, the National Park Service, just established just after at the turn of the century in 1905. So really this huge push to, one, take into account some of the emissions and other pollutants that were being produced by the industrialization, and then two, to set aside wild areas to conserve different landscapes, but I don't think it was necessarily so organized that you wanted to have sort of the, like, biodiverse areas preserved, as opposed to just larger areas that were fairly untouched and could conserve different species. But sort of in our little timeline and history here, this takes us kind of up to what is, I think, an interesting hiatus. It's not to say that there wasn't any environmentalism or activism about the environment after the creation of the Park Service. But it really does seem like there was a decrease in such thinking for quite a long time, actually.
Well, so I don't know if there's a decrease in the thinking per se, but it was not at the forefront of political concern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you run from, yes, and you know, Algonquin, like, for a Canadian context, you know, Algonquin Park was established in 1893, the National Park Service being established in the U.S. in 1905. But then there's a bit of a jump because, you know, you have World War I,
couple wars,
a Great Depression, yep. World War II, and basically, you know, it was not top of mind. It was, you know, straight up survival, maintaining the airs and the water and the soil kind of just got pushed back in terms of multiple periods of total war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Losses of generations of adults. Yeah.
Which is absolutely 100% understandable. And this is like one of these things where you see the various disconnects and, you know, thinking of like doing a tie back to early paleontology, and there's always, when you see some of the earliest paleo limnal work, there's always some reference to like work done in the English Lake District in the early 1940s. And I always have a huge disconnect with that of like,
was there a war on?
how, you know, like I'm sure they were very far removed from the Blitz and stuff, but like in terms of my family history connections to the war and stuff, just the idea of, you know, just going out and doing science and working on your PhD during the Blitz and D-Day and all of that kind of stuff just seems so.
I'm sure there were lots. There was bizarre. Lots to read in the newspaper when you were having your lunch.
Yeah, it's like, and you know, just different worlds going on at the same time. But anyway,
yeah, you're writing in your notebook. Took core today. Read the Allies stormed Anzio.
It's baffling to kind of process how. And I'm sure in many places around the world, the war seemed very far away. But But anyway, but because of those, in terms of, you know, headline level stuff, there's a fairly big gap. And so we kind of, when we slice this all up, we're talking about like, you know, environmental activism and the Industrial Revolution / Western expansion. And then there's a big jump until the post-war Great Acceleration and the impact that had on broader environmental activism.
And this is where we get back a little bit closer to some of the things we started talking about on the last episode related to acid rain and things like that. And much of it, what I originally would have thought started with Silent Spring, which is the book by Rachel Carson that we've referenced a couple times in this. But it turns out actually the World Wildlife Fund was founded before that, which I had no idea.
Yeah. And just, so 1962 would be when Silent Spring was published, and the World Wildlife Fund, 61. And I think it grew out of something even a bit earlier, which makes sense. Well, I mean, things like the Sierra Club were established in the 1890s.
Yeah. Oh so yeah. There were environmental kind of activism groups for sure.
They existed, but, for whatever reason with the WWF, with the, I'd always thought it was a slightly newer thing than that, or in part a response to the sentiments whipped up in the
exactly not too long after that.
And so for those that are unfamiliar, Silent Spring was largely today I'd refer to like a popular science book. That was focused on the impact of pesticides, particularly things like DDT that were having on the broader environment. And the Silent Spring is a reference to basically the birds being eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Because of the softening of eggshells and all that kind of stuff that those organochlorine pesticides result in.
And so, pesticides would be one big thing that when I think of what galvanized what we think of as the environmental activism today, there'd be a couple of, I guess, key issues. One being pesticide use, another being acid deposition, so acid rain, basically, the eutrophication or fertilization of, freshwaters and coastal waters. It's not always lumped in with the other ones, but I always think the impacts of lead and gasoline slots right in terms of the same general timeline.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Identifying, so you get like a couple of different components to that. There's the human health part, because, you know, you think about the poisoning of animals, and the linkage to humans is an easy one to be concerned about. And that ties into the leaded gasoline and just huge amounts of lead in the environment, resulting in potential for all sorts of negative human health impacts, including birth defects and all those kind of things.
Neurological issues.
Yeah. And then the second being the potential loss of, I wouldn't say keystone species, but more charismatic species. So again, you know, in the same way of the conservation aspect, not hearing birds in the springtime is something that's very easy to imagine, or seeing the loss of fish from lakes due to acidification, or fish kills in coastal zones because of huge eutrophication and anoxia. So you get this kind of interest and fixation on realizing the potential for harm to organisms that we're familiar with and really enjoy. And because of that, there's the potential to galvanize public opinion again.
And as always, bringing in our nerdy interests, I was not aware of this until you told me, but that Silent Spring was also one of the inspirations for the novel Dune by Frank Herbert.
Yeah, yeah, which is what I would say my favorite book, probably. It's one that I mean, the one of the quotes from it, which is actually not in the main book, but is related to ecology, is at the beginning of my PhD thesis, and I actually have it on a board on the wall behind me here. But it's been referred to in a bunch of different ways. So it's been referred to as the Sand County Almanac in Space, which is a book from the 30s by Aldo Leopold on conservation. And it's well documented that Herbert was highly influenced by all the goings on at this time, including Silent Spring, even though some of the book had obviously been written by 1962. But just the environmentalism and the linkage to taking things that were happening on Earth and setting them in a different context, in a science fiction sort of fantasy perspective, but being able to bring those ideas out. And it's a very popular novel right away, and one that caused an environmental knowledge in an audience that may not have been, you know, so up on reading Silent Spring, for example, but did read this book and got a little bit out of that. So
you'll be there on opening night whenever the new, is it like,
oh, absolutely, the next movie comes? Absolutely. Okay. I will be first in line. I'm not that, I don't, you know, go to movies on opening weekend, even ones that I'm interested in the franchise, but this will be the exception.
Will you be wearing a homemade still suit?
They do look pretty cool. They do. No, I'm not. I'm not really a cosplayer. But hey, you never know.
Yeah.
It looks like it'd be good. We'll have to have an episode on it.
It's our, you know, this is our hobby-driven podcast.
That's right.
We can cross the streams anytime.
That's right. Perfect. Yeah. Anyway, but in that time period, there's like, the 60s, yeah. And the identification of a bunch of different environmental challenges, for sure. And then in response to that, there was a real proliferation of environmental activism groups, many of which we know the names of now.
Yeah. So the biggest one, I guess, or I don't know.
Loudest one.
Hugest amount of mind share, I guess, would be one way to do it. Would be Greenpeace, which was established somewhere between 69 and 72. I guess it depends on where you exactly put the beginnings, but it was itself an offshoot of the Sierra Club. And then a little bit later, when we talk about, I guess, you know, issues, environmental issues of public consciousness, a big one would becoming Save the Whales. And so then the Sea Shepherds themselves were in turn an offshoot of Greenpeace, I guess, a decade later in the late 70s.
Yeah, still earlier than I imagined for some reason, too.
Yeah.
So basically, that's what I've learned from this research and thinking about this episode, is that most of these organizations are older than I thought they were.
Yeah, well, it's funny when you go and like try and piece the timeline together. And in many ways, you know, the early 60s was just a seminal period in history, and, you know, culturally in a bunch of ways. And so it's like, you know, like Silent Spring in 62, going back to the Peppered Moths, it's like, you know, the increases that referred to earlier really seem to date back to the early 60s. It's just, you know, public consciousness brought this to the forefront, which in turn, you know, protest movements, you know,
So many things,
activism, voting, time. Like stuff got done.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, and it was a time of, I guess, extremes. So you'd have like Sudbury, you know, due to acid deposition, just devegetated.
Yeah. So much so that they were training for the moon in Sudbury.
And, you know, it's kind of funny. It comes up every time I look into this. Apparently, so the moon, landing on the moon in 1969, so late 60s, same kind of time, you had NASA training astronauts in Sudbury. Apparently had more to do with geological formations than the fact that it looked like a moonscape. It was something
specific. Just the rocks where they expected would be similar?
I don't know if it was a rock. Okay, now I'm, you know, getting...
Well, that makes sense.
Talking about my butt a fair bit here, but it's going to be, I think, because the Sudbury formations is a big impact crater.
Yeah, right? Massive. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's something related to that, which is why they had NASA there. But I guess the popular, you know,
so yeah, still learned
down into why is like, oh, because it looks like the moon. And it's like, well, it's not that it looks like the moon, but yes, it does kind of look like the moon.
Yeah, makes sense. But
you can quote me on that. And then
I'm going to, I will be mentioning this in my geomorphology class starting in the fall.
Excellent. I don't even know what geomorphology means. but then at the same time, eutrophication, we're dealing with, you know, I guess the highly publicized quote unquote death of Lake Erie would fall into this time due to, over-fertilization, and the quest to identify, or not the quest, I guess, maybe it's a quest, different sides of what was the primary nutrient responsible for a lot of eutrophication, of like, was it nitrogen? Was it phosphorus?
Yeah.
Was
huge vested interest.
You know, led to the formation of the experimental lakes area, or in large part led to the formation of the experimental lakes area in 1968, which we've talked a little bit about. And that's where you have like the super iconic photo in limnology of the lake separated by a curtain to, on one side, fertilizing it with carbon and nitrogen, and on the other side, carbon and phosphorus. And just to see what was the cause for these kind of algal blooms.
Yep.
You had, I guess this would be around the same time that you had the equivalent of like the Detroit River catching on fire due to improper treatment of, I have no idea what that would have been attributable to in terms of what
I'm the not sure were
that led actually. To the water and the river actually catching on fire. But, you know, all this kind of stuff all came to a head at the same time.
Yeah, but like, what an image to galvanize public opinion.
Yeah, rivers catching on fire. It's tough, very tough to peddle a message of, move along, nothing to see here. It's like,
yeah,
the river's on fire. What are we going to put it out with?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the same way in like the oil spill kind of the Deepwater Horizon 50 or 40 years later. Those are images that stick in people's heads.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so the big ones we mentioned already, resistance to nuclear power, or just nuclear in general, like initially it was totally focused on nuclear weapons, but grew more writ large. And then you had like the accidents of Three Mile Island in the 70s and Chernobyl, which happened much later in the 80s. So you know, that ties in with Greenpeace. Save the whales became a serious slogan of in the environmental movement in general. And that in part led in many ways. I'm not sure why it was the Sea Shepherds split off to become their own thing, but that obviously was their
focus,
raison d'etre in many ways. Mm-hmm. And we talk about changing public consciousness, and you mentioned Dune as one of your favorite novels. Moby Dick is actually one of mine, and this is kind of pretty crystallizes just the general change in popular sentiment. You have Moby Dick in terms of, you know, one of the all-time great adventure stories slash whaling textbooks.
Written in 1851.
Describing in incredible detail how brutal whaling actually was, and harpooning.
Everything about the shape of harpoons and the rigging of the ship.
And
rendering down a whale.
Yeah, chopping a whale up that was bigger.
It's an anatomy textbook size too. Yeah.
To the boat that they were capturing them on, and then rendering them down for the fat, the oil to bring back. And it was like a great, commercial endeavor and just good fun.
That's it.
And then jump ahead to 1986 and Star Trek IV. And it's like, the whales are extinct and we have to, fly back in time, slingshotting around the sun in order to bring two whales from the 80s to save all of humanity, because the morons, they killed them all.
They killed all the whales. We need these two humpbacks to be brought back to the future in order to save future Earth. So they pick San Francisco of all... San Francisco, right? Yeah, the Golden
Gate Bridge
is in it. Yep. See all the hippies tying into the anti-war protests we've been talking about a little bit. Yeah, and there you go. Put him onto a Klingon warbird, and there you go.
And so I think it just, encapsulates, 130 years between those two things, and just the mind shift, at least in popular culture, whatever that's worth. Who knows how well they would have done if you reverse the release dates, but...
not well. except to show TV to people in 1850. What is this?
But nature will bring nature to heal versus nature is our salvation.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting kind of spin on the whole thing.
All related to whales.
Yeah. That was a digression. Yeah. And so then I guess we're getting closer and closer to the periods of time that Josh and I actually remember here, although I do remember going to see as a kid, Star Trek IV in the theaters, but
I was 1 year old when that movie was released. So,
I would have been 8, and, I definitely remember going, and probably most of it went over my head other than like the spaceship bits.
Yeah. It's a good movie though.
Yeah. I've not seen it in so long. I'm totally going to look it up after this.
I think it's on, on Netflix. I'm not sure.
I actually did check that. It is not. The shows are, but the movies are not. The movies are, it must be somewhere else.
They can be found. And anyway, as
we go.
Yeah, exactly. As we move into the modern time period.
Yeah. So now we're into the period of actual memory for the pair of us. A big one that I kind of refer to a lot in the work that I do is the impact of the Clean Air Act in 1990. All of a sudden, you had a bi-national response to acid deposition in a big way. And, in many ways, acid rain is a good news story, I guess. I guess we never really mentioned the ozone layer as a separate, and that would also fall into the thing. But the ozone layer is, by and large, a good news story that seems to be, as a kid, I definitely remember, this will grow, thinking of like the doomsday kind of, you follow the narrative to the extreme, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Eventually everyone will, die of cancer instantly kind of thing as it's gone.
And it's now, a slow heal, but it is moving in the right direction.
Acid deposition, it's definitely not, definitely movement has been in the right direction. There's all kinds of issues related to the legacy of acid rain, but you know, acid sulfate deposition in general.
Yeah, especially for sulfate, yeah.
And again, we have our own biases here, being Canadian, but in Eastern North America is much less of a thing than it was. Other regions of the world, it is still a big, big issue.
Yeah, more of an emerging concern there, yep.
But then, you know, events continue to happen, and Josh mentioned it earlier, following this timeline, we had the Atlantic cod collapse. So 1992 is when the moratorium was enacted, with the biomass down to something like 1% of the what it was historically. I don't know very much about this. I have vague recollections of this being in the news.
I also vaguely remember that. Like, this is the time period that I start to remember more kind of national or international news personally, and have a vague recollection of seeing people, you know, on the news fighting with their politicians over the moratorium.
Yeah, and I understand it's like been so that what was that, 1992, pushing almost 20 years. I think they teased opening it a little while, a couple of years ago, but it's still,
well, there is some, like, there's very limited, not like harvesting in the way it was, but there is some harvest of cod, but from different mechanisms, you know, the trawling of them is not going to happen for a while.
But it is not a good news story yet.
No, it's a complicated issue for sure. And then I guess we move into the, you know, the modern era and the, whatever we call it, the information revolution. Is that the current term for it? And really, we talk about these global concerns. It's not about hunting of one species in one area to endangerment or extinction. It's about the greenhouse gas emissions at a global scale, even if it's not synchronous and or it's not uniform in where those emissions are coming from. It's still mostly the developed world, but it's a global problem.
Yeah. And so, yeah, although it's kind of funny in many ways, I don't know if I've talked about this in podcasts before, but thinking about, you know, climate change as it's as like a post-2000s kind of era, but that's when it became a real political issue. Like, I remember doing a science project on what was then largely referred to as the greenhouse effect, mm-hmm. In grade 7, maybe, so that would be in the very late 80s, on books pulled out from the library. Like, it wasn't a fringe thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, published, no, work absolutely on
it.
Not.
And it was like a well-known thing, and it was just, but it was very much,
who cares?
A problem for the future. That's, yeah, a problem for future Earth kind of thing.
Yeah.
Outside of the people ringing an alarm bell. And then global warming and climate change became, I guess, a bit more commonly known phrases. And then you had the release of, I guess, An Inconvenient Truth in 2006. And at least in an American context, it just became, it went from being a global health issue to a political issue.
Yeah.
Basically, almost overnight. I mean, it always was, but
that there was always a political, like, slant on it, but
that was just, yeah, like team red, team blue. These are our points on it, and game on.
Yep. Yeah, literally overnight.
So in issues to deal with today, we also have overpopulation, and I always think this is kind of crazy, thinking of, like, okay, beginning of our story, or this episode in the early 1800s, talking about 1 billion people on the planet. My parents were born in the 50s. There are about 3 billion people on the planet. I was born in the 70s. 4 billion people on the planet. My kids were born in the last couple of years, and there's now 8 billion people on the planet. Like, the, so compared, so
truly exponential.
Parent to grandparent, you know, there's quadruple the number of people on the planet just for my parents. Like, yes, we don't know anyone alive from, you know, the early 1800s right now, but especially in this coronavirus world we're living in right now, I'm talking to my parents every day, and
yeah,
or almost every day. And yeah, you know, just the crazy that, you know, looking to, like, on our way to triple the number of people from the day that they were born.
Yeah. And that presents real challenges, no doubt, for everything, not just for you know, the common things about emissions that we talked about and feeding that many people, but at every level, that's something to be planned for
or dealt with. There's not all, I think that seems to be a common thread through all this, is it's very little proactive. It's always reactive.
It does seem like that. I mean, I'm sure you could pick out a couple of examples in there that have been not many of them looking back over the list.
Yeah, it'd be an exception to the rule, but really, definitely. It's like, will the point of no return be crossed seems to be the thing. And then, you know, passerbingen, yes. Bison, almost. Dodo, yes. Humpback whales, no. But it's not...
Ozone layer, no. You know.
Yeah. So in terms of the timeline, so I guess, yeah, the big modern mind share issues of the day, climate change, overpopulation. One that you're seeing more and more of on a global context is plastic pollution.
Yeah. Which we talked about last time a little bit. It maybe lost a little bit of the everyday discussion on genetically modified organisms, though it's certainly still out there. But that certainly not too long ago was a very common topic to be considered. But I think I'm sure there's still people going on about GMO organisms. But it seems like that's died down a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think it was one of those things where I don't think it ever had the universality of like a climate change. Mm-hmm. Like, depending on who you're talking to today, you'd still have to begin with an explainer, right?
About what a genetically modified organism is?
Yeah, and why it's a problem or not a problem or what the issue is, I guess. Whereas there are very few people that I ever encounter that, you know, no matter what side of the red-blue divide they would fall on in terms of the importance of climate change, no one's going to go, what? What are you talking about? Like, you know, we're at a point now that everyone knows exactly what that issue is.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is the case for GMOs.
That's fair. But we also, I guess, whether it's the shift in the media cycle and the 24-hour news and the prevalence of social media and everyone has a, you know, YouTube page and things like that, that we really do.
Or a podcast.
Yes. Exactly. That we really have, I don't know. And I'm sure it was the same. It would have been the same if all of these tools had been available during the protest movements of the 60s. But there are some pretty powerful activism forces out there, the Greta Thunbergs of the world, and more locally than that, we have lots of different examples of people fighting for the environment, and that's a thing to be celebrated. I think
Greta Thunberg is such an interesting story, like at least in my own kind of perception, because when she first kind of blew up onto the scene, I was like pretty meh. How old was she when she was making international headlines? Like, she's like 16.
16? Now. Yeah.
15? No, so she'd been like 14?
I don't know.
Or something like that when we would first heard her. And it's like, okay, she's making a stink. I'm sure she's being well managed in order for me to have heard about her, kind of thing. And I was like, meh. But, a year or two later, I'm, like person of the year in 2019, my perception has massively changed in terms of like she moved the needle in a way that, no one, so who cares? I'm not particularly interested in how much of an individual is versus how managed she is, but like, she moved the conversation in a way that, has not been done since Silent Spring, I would say, yeah, anyways.
For sure. The protests when, the global days of action related to climate change and the school walkouts on Fridays, that still go on. It's not something that's done. I mean, sure, we've taken a bit of a pause as
not right now.
The world, yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. The world has taken a bit of a pause on all sorts of different topics. But that's a long, long time that that continues. And the number of people at some of those marches in different cities around the world is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting in terms of, you know, the fact that Neil got pushed because she leaned so heavily into the red-blue divide. Or not lean, but did not shy away when the President of the United States was like, you know, trying to slam dunk on her.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, she is in.
And then got responses as opposed to being ignored, which I think is what kind of really like made it so big.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. I'm sure there'll be, you know, when all is said and done, when the world goes back to some semblance of normality, whatever normal is, but like a return from like the current virus-induced lockdown that we're sitting in, what will happen on the the Greta file and the environmental file going forward in terms of has some momentum there potentially been lost again? You know, it's like events, dear boy, events in terms of the way that the wars and the Great Depression, particularly, I guess I'm thinking here in terms of the Great Depression, like, you know, financial issues pushed things onto the back burner. And are we on the cusp of something similar happening?
Yeah, I think that's not a bad place to kind of wrap up this discussion, is just the unknown associated with, you know, where we are at the moment in this everything coronavirus, everything COVID-19. What is the future? Do we go back to where we were? Do we accelerate back into, you know, back to the economy? Let's get the stock market as high as it can go. All of those things. Do we go a different direction? Where do we find ourselves for these topics? And the jury is still out on that one.
Yeah. Although, I think one of my takeaways from all of this is, you know, how irrelevant the performance of the stock market is to the general populace in many ways. It's like it's chugging along just fine without people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm not
worker
saying that.
Being away, it's like...
but I mean, but from an industrial, you know, as production globally ramps back up, which it will do at some point, whether it's a year from now, whether it's whatever... where we put our energies.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. What kind of mark this 2-month hiatus will have in terms of all, you know, just bring this back into like normal paleo. Like, will spring of 2020, what kind of paleolimnological fingerprint is it going to be leaving going forward with production ramping down on... Not completely, but, you know, air travel is shut down.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt that emissions will be low.
But how low? Is it going to be?
Oh, like, I mean, it's
2016 low or, you know, like.
Yeah, no. It's a small decrease in a continuing to increase trend.
I just rolled the clock. And so 2020 is just like a couple of years. Probably a couple years ago. Or a bigger one. I don't know. Very interesting to see how that all plays
out. Well, it still does depend on how long this continues, but we are, you know, we're pushing at something like that, but it's not decades.
And anything else you want to talk about on this kind of front?
No, I think it's been a good
rambling timeline, I guess, of things that we found interesting on this topic.
Mm-hmm. I learned some things on this one, actually.
Yeah, I think it's interesting for me largely putting it on a timeline, because I don't think there was too many things that I had not at least heard of before that we covered today, like had some level of interest. But what was interesting was trying to put them together in a jigsaw puzzle. And then it's like, you know, I think I mentioned, you know, I already talked about a little bit earlier with like the westward expansion in the U.S. happening around, you know, like there were many ways exploring Yellowstone, you know, like just a couple of years before declaring it a park. It's like that kind of blew my mind a little bit of, okay, I really don't have a good timeline for that.
I think it's neat how there are these like nodes of acceleration in some of these thinking. So the initial one we talked about, and then all of these changes in the 60s. And now I would argue we're hopefully at one of those right now, related to, you know, all different things coming together, social, economic, political, whatever they may be. Yeah, it's interesting to see that they kind of coalesce around these points in history.
And I guess, yeah, one last thing, just going back, that I thought I'd touch on, but it didn't really slot in really nice, really well in any way. But also talking about the Greta Thunberg issue would be, scientists don't make good spokespeople.
Well, some do, but many don't.
By and large, don't make good spokespeople. And that is probably another element of her elevation, I guess, into the public consciousness.
Yeah, because she is not a lab coat wearing scientist.
No, she's a kid.
Yep. Speaking of lab coats or things, what's this about this t-shirt that you had a great idea for?
Well, it's kind of what I was trying to turn the conversation to with this. Because that whole, public sentiment, we talked about the bacon and egg heads talks, like scientists as activists in various levels. A paper, I think we mentioned it last time, written by my supervisor, John Small, looking at, getting involved, getting the message out. So this contagious ideas, how do you spread the word and get people to listen to you? And one of the things I thought was interesting is like the public view of academics is really quite high. And then one of my own thoughts related to that is that high esteem related to lack of outreach? And is it a case of Schrodinger's academic esteem? It's like, you know, you are believed because you never say anything. But once you start talking, that esteem will evaporate.
I love it.
And that could be worked into a core ideas t-shirt somehow.
We'll be taking orders. We won't be able to fulfill them until all of this craziness ends and we can find
a t-shirt. They can be made in massive factories on production lines of the millions.
That's right. But look out for those in the hopefully not too distant future. Schrodinger's Academic Esteem t-shirts, Core Ideas branded.
Yeah.
I'll be wearing mine for sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
But I guess.
Anything else?
On that note.
Any mail bag this week? I don't think so.
Well, let me check the mailbag.
Click, click, click.
There's nothing in the mailbag.
Shocking.
So we'll check again next week.
Yeah.
But we have had some Twitter responses, which is kind of cool.
Shout out to always, Josh Gurek this week, the Twitter follower of the week, who liked our Adams. Adam does all of the graphics of us on TV from an old picture from Pals we talked about a couple weeks ago.
But if you. Hopefully you like this episode. It's a little bit of a divergence from what we normally do, but we love feedback. So give us a shout out at easiest way or most direct way would be on Twitter.
At Core Ideas Paleo, P-A-L-E-O.
Something longer can be sent to us by email at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. You can check out all the old show notes on coreideas.ajeziorski.ca, but I think you can find a link to that on the Twitter. Twitter would be the landing page for any kind of contact for us, and then you can spread out from there. But we do have the website if you ever wanted to look back at old episodes or old shows.
Yeah, and this is
old notes.
As we said, this is the first episode in our third arc on contagious ideas, and we're gonna expand a little bit. We'll go back to some paleo science in a couple weeks. We're going to spread these out a little bit just because they're taking a little more research than the initial ones. So it'll be a couple weeks between episodes. But I think next time we're going to talk about some historically significant papers and projects kind of delve into some of those classics.
And we'll begin with the ones that we think are really interesting. So key stuff, I guess, like the ELA.
Yeah.
The ELA will figure prominently. But as always, if you think we're missing anything, let us know.
Sounds good. And if not, everyone take care out there. And we will be back in a little bit. And stay safe.
Yeah. Thanks for listening and catch you next time.